Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
Silver Machine by Hawkwind.
Well, Lemmy singing. Who else could it be in that?
What a song.
Well, it's an amazing song. But what I love about that, I'm going to talk bass as soon as we start the show today, because the bass is like, he's playing like a 12-bar blues. He's like doing the double note thing, you know, the double stop thing, the same as the guitar, you know, and that's, you know, he carried on doing that, didn't he?
Yeah,
Lemmy just went
yeah.
mad. You know, and that thunderous sound. But, you know, I think it really is distinctive with his voice. And Dave Brock, who produced it, he created these incredible noises. The whole band created these incredible noises. And this was recorded live, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was recorded live at a Greasy Truckers benefit gig at the Roundhouse in London in 1972. And they released it as a single on 9th of June in that year. And it got to number 3 in the charts.
Well.
Get in there. And they were one of the earliest space rock groups with, like, because they had lots of urban and sci-fi themes. Now, I don't really know a lot about Hawkwind. And it's been quite intense and quite thick, the research for this. It's taken me ages to... It's like spaghetti. They've just kind of dumped it on the floor because there's so many people getting in and joining the band and leaving the band and getting sacked from the band. And
it was chaos.
It was. And it's trying to make sense of it all. I've been really kind of breaking it down. So they were formed in 1969.
Okay.
And they've gone through many incarnations from hard to progressive to psychedelic rock, which is quite good. So at least it's like an organic thing.
Well, there was a great recount of the tale of how Lemmy left in his...
I remember that
film, isn't there? It's called Lemmy, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we watched it, watched it about 3 or 4 times, and it's fantastic. But he got fired, and he didn't even know about it, did he?
Oh, no, that's right, because
he got locked up, or he got arrested
for possession of illegal drugs.
Yeah.
And they buggered off without him.
That's right.
Oh, that's it, because he didn't turn up, but he got arrested. And then when he did rock up, they sacked him anyway.
That's right.
So it's just like, hey, up.
And can you imagine sacking Lemmy? We always say in this house, what would Lemmy do?
Exactly, you know?
It was a problem, so what would Lemmy do right
hot
now?
Hot pants or really hot pants? You call those shorts?
Well, I saw Hawkwind, but I can't remember anything about it because, well, I don't want to discuss it too much on the air, but I can't remember anything about it really, except for the naked woman with the big boobies.
What is that about?
Well, she was dancing around the aisle. I went with Tim Wright, the singer from our old band, Whitefire. And, and I couldn't remember anything about it, but I'll remember as that, really. And I remember it being just a wash of sound, you know, and it was very space, very trippy sort of experience, yeah, at the Apollo in Manchester.
Well, that's really... Because of the success of this song, Hawkwind had enough money to do that tour, and they called it. They went on a do-re-mi-fa-sol-la-ti-do space ritual tour, just so you know. And that's when the dancers, Stacia and Miss Renee, joined the band. Stacia, that's right. She was either topless or wearing body paint. And there was a mime artist, Tony Carrera, and a light show by Liquid Len.
It's chaos. I mean, it's a great, but what a great song. I mean, the thing is, the song still stands up, doesn't it? Because
it's a great
chorus, great verse. And, you know, you can actually play it on acoustic guitar if you want. But it really is, you know. And it's got something that really started this whole thing off, this whole movement off. And it was mixed and overdubbed at Morgan Studios, which featured a Kadak desk again, one of my favourite consoles.
Geek.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I can't believe it was done live.
Well, no, the original vocals, though, were actually sung from that live version by Robert Calvert.
Ah.
But they weren't right, so he suffered from bipolar, and he'd actually been sectioned at the time.
No.
So he couldn't redo the vocals. So they went through all the band trying to see who else would you know, sing the live vocal, the main vocal line. And Lemmy was the last guy to be asked, and he did it in a oneer.
Fantastic.
But it's weird, though. I was just thinking this. It's like Lemmy, you know, he joins a band because the bass player doesn't turn up. He just, you know, so he's in. The lead singer can't redo the vocals, and okay, they go around the houses, but he does a great job, and he's
Won't be the same song with that.
No, but I think these guys were a bit of a handful actually, because when they were recording their album In Search of Space in 1971, they originally started off at George Martin's Air Studios, right?
But that's a disaster waiting to happen.
Well, after a week with little or no progress, and the studio engineers reported that they actually didn't want to work with him. And apparently what they did is they broke into George Martin's drink cabinet, pinched all his booze and spiked the engineer's with acid.
guitar and play. Just like yesterday. Then I'll get on my knees and pray. We don't get fooled again. No, no. We'll be right back.
The Horrible Who, Won't Get Fooled Again, from the fifth studio album, Who's Next, released August 1971.
Wow, what a track.
Well, it's huge. You know, and the thing about that song is that it's very much perfect rock and roll song. I don't think John Entwistle overplays, because I think a lot of John Entwistle stuff, he overplays on that, he doesn't.
Yeah.
Moon's drums sound amazing, produced and engineered, well, associate produced by Glyn Johns, of course. That's why the drums sound so good.
Yep.
The guitar is magnificent. It's strident, it's power chords, it's got all those beautiful suspensions on it. And he was using a Gretsch, Chet Atkins, I think, through a Fender Bandmaster, and I know it was a 3x10 Bandmaster, the same one that we've got.
Wow.
Because we had one built exactly the same as that, from that 50s thing.
Yeah,
and it was given to him by Joe Walsh in New York. Because didn't they start this record in America?
Yeah, and the record plant, they didn't really gel. So they, when they went to Stargrove, Jagger's pad, which obviously appears again.
He must have made loads of money off these bands recording.
He probably wasn't there, though, was he?
No.
Half the time. And they had the Rolling Stones mobile truck. And they...
With a Helios desk, great.
Yeah, so what happened, though, what's quite interesting about this, you know, when we watched that interview with Pete Townshend, he's actually a really intelligent and really lovely bloke.
He is.
You don't realise that. If you just saw him on stage, you wouldn't know what's in his head.
No.
You had no idea. But he, after they had their fantastic success with that 1969 album, Tommy, Pete Townshend was writing a follow-up. It was like going to be like a rock opera called Lifehouse, but that ended up being shelved. And it was all about how spiritual enlightenment could be obtained via a combination of band and audience. And he'd read this book by Inayat Khan, The Mysticism of Sound and Music, and it referred to some sort of spiritual harmony in the universal chord, which could restore harmony to humanity when sounded. Now, this is the beginning.
Now, where's that rock opera when you need it?
Well, exactly.
We could do one of those right now.
But what I like about what Pete did was that he went to the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, and they gave him some ideas for capturing human personality with music. And he went and interviewed a load of people, like sort of like a GP kind of style questions.
No.
Captured their heartbeat, their brainwaves, and their astrological charts, and converted them into a series of audio pulses.
No.
This is just for the demo, right?
Woo!
So then he linked a Lowry organ into an EMS VCS3
right,
filter.
And the VCS3, of course, made famous by Pink Floyd.
Of course.
From Dark Side of the Moon, that's right.
So that's really... So what do you hear all that? I was listening to the pulses then and all the organ sounds, thinking that that's been connected to a human heartbeat or a human psyche.
That's incredible.
So what happened when Glyn Johns, when he got involved in the project after New York, when he went to Stargrove, I was reading about the fact that the demo was so blinking great and the organ sounds that they actually kept the original stuff that Pete had done.
So it was a Larry organ through a VCS3. Well, it sounds, it's like filtered, you can hear it, but it just sounds great. The fantastic thing about that is that Keith Moon, I mean, he was a crazy mother, you know, an unbelievable guy, but he actually played along to that because it was like, obviously, like a sequence, you know?
Yeah.
But without any click track, this wasn't a click track of theirs, you know, he was actually doing it live, which is amazing and really, really cool, you know? No hi-hat again, because he never used to use one, just smashing the living daylights out of the cymbals and the toms and everything. But it's one of those quintessential tracks. And then Roger Daltrey's scream at the end is just, you know, blood-curdling. You get that on loud, you know. It sounds fantastic.
And the bass sounds like a hippopotamus in a mudslide halfway through that. It's just like, ooh. And you hear it. And then it changes at the end. It's not smooth and as hippopotamus-like.
Well, I think if there's a perfect rock song out there, I think that's probably it.
Dug and dug and dug and dug and dug, 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 dug riding, in the stallion that I'm riding, never ride. La da 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 da. Juggle, 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 juggle. Da 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 da. Of the Spanish main out, Deborah. Da 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 da. Juggery dug and juggery dug, juggery dug. Da 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 da. Juggery dug and juggery dug, we dug.
Tyrannosaurus Rex and Deborah. That was released as a single on EMI's Regal Xonophone label in 1968 and got to number 34 in the UK charts. Darling.
Regal Xonophone?
Yeah, I think it's
a great name. Who didn't want to be on Regal Xonophone record?
Well, it was all linked to Tony Visconti, wasn't it? That was one of his...
Right.
Which is interesting, though, because they were Tyrannosaurus Rex at that point. They weren't T-Rex.
Yeah, and was it Visconti that asked him to
change
the name? Yeah, because, you know, I mean, I'm about to read the Visconti book, so I don't know very much about the in-depth thing here.
Yeah.
What I do know, though, is that in 1968, Mark Bone was a superstar. And I think the reason why we played this one is that it's such a raw acoustic version, and it's still got the energy. And, you know, the timing's moving around a little bit, but his guitar's great and his voice is great. And he has an amazing way of creating a hook that just sticks in your mind, that da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know. It's just incredible. And then Deborah, and, you know, you keep singing it in your head.
Well, I keep thinking, he's got a lot of vibrato in his voice. It's da-ba-dee-da.
Yeah, very fast.
Yeah. It's very unusual.
Yeah. Bit like Roger Chapman, you know, from Family, you know, because that whole thing, similar sort of thing. But, you know, but he had everything, didn't he? Because he then, you know, he started dressing up. There's some sexual ambiguity with him as well.
Yeah, he was openly bisexual. Yeah.
Which was the thing that was going on at that time. And I think that's probably why he associated with Bowie, and Bowie got involved with the whole thing, you know. And it was a great, you know, and this Visconti, of course, who was Bowie's longtime producer on and off.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, it's a great story. And there were a few personnel changes, but, you know, and when they did the later stuff with the more rock and roll, you know, Get It On, Bang a Gong and all that sort of stuff, you know, it was a progression from this. But it just proves here that he can write a great song and perform it in a very exciting way, just with an acoustic guitar and some bongos.
Thank you.
Steely Dan, Don't Take Me Alive, from the Royal Scam 1976 on ABC Records. Went gold, peaked at number 15 in the US album charts.
Steely Dan.
Do you know what it's short for? Do you know what it is, a Steely Dan? It's a prophylactic, i.e. a condom. That is what a Steely Dan is in the States. You didn't know that, did you?
Well, now, I've not told you anything because I've got secret notes here.
All right.
Right, because I've only discovered today where actually the name of the band came from. You're so close.
Is that right? Go on.
So close. But I'm going to blush if I have to say the words.
Right, okay. Okay. Well, blush.
Right, okay. It's taken from a William Burroughs book called Naked Lunch.
Okay.
Which is quite hot.
Hot?
I've read some of the text. It's dirty.
Oh,
and a Steely Dan was a rubber strap-on.
Is that right?
Yeah, because in the book it says Steely Dan the Third from Yokohama, and then it describes other things which we can't talk about. So I've been sat here for now for the last few hours on and off thinking about the fact that that's why I said Steely Dan, because I can't believe that these guys, and Rolling Stone calls them the perfect musical anti-heroes for the 70s. And their music is so produced and beautiful, yeah. And they're named
a strap-on. Well, strap a dick to me. Anyway, let's...
Wow, interesting.
Let's
though.
Carry on. Well, Larry Carlton,
yes,
played lead guitar on that. A magnificent... magnificent performance, very appropriate, beautiful sound, bit rockier than he normally plays. But that, you know, with Gary Katz's production, Roger Nichols engineering, you know, they went on as a team through all the Steely Dan albums and the Donald Fagen albums, of course, yeah. Like Nightfly we had on last week, a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, it's just oozes class. And is Bernard Purdy on this?
No, he's on the album. He was actually on the album.
Right. Did he play on this though? I don't know.
I think
he
did.
No, I think he did, actually. And, you know, the hit maker. Apparently, he's a bit of a pain in the ass, Bernard Purdy, because every time I read anything about him, apparently he's a little bit full of himself, yes. And he puts on his drum stands when he's recording, you know, the hit maker. He's a great drummer, like. I mean, there's some YouTube videos. I was watching him. The Purdy Shuffle. He does this Purdy Shuffle, and it is so good. So groovy. And he says, the slower it is, the more groovy it is. And he's like, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful the shuffle. But apparently, it's a bit of a pain in the ass. But, you know, Steely Dan. Sadly, we lost Walter Becker pretty recently. Donald Fagen's still going, of course. And, you know, but I think they were a right pain in the ass to work with. And I think increasingly so, because, they got perfection and then they wanted more perfection.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting as well, because I found out that, you know, Tim B. Schmidt from the Eagles, he sang backing vocals on the track The Royal Scam before he joined the Eagles.
Right. Well, the whole, yeah. And didn't you go and see him? Didn't you
I
see
did.
Him with the Eagles?
I did. Yeah, he's my favourite bass player. Well, it's just that I just love this song called I Can't Tell You Why. And I was right at the front and I just remember crying because I didn't think they'd play it because I was a sucker for a good ballad. There he was, stood in front of me in this whole band. I'm thinking, oh my God, it's the Eagles. This is just weird. It's like a college lunchtime concert, you know, because they just looked like real people. It was so cool.
And this is a long time before you started playing bass, wasn't it? Really?
Oh, God, yeah. Absolutely. Playing bass, I wouldn't even consider it. I wouldn't have thought about it at all. I just loved the song, and he happened to be singing the lead vocals on it.
Well, the Eagles are another band, you know, with the great harmony vocals and very beautiful songwriting, you know. But back to Steely Dan, anyway. The Royal Scam, great record, and Kid Charmaine's on that. I mean, I think it's one of my favourites, I think.
May you never lay your head down without a hand to hold. May I never make you mad out in the cold. Just like a greeting song, brother of mine, you know that I love you true. You never talk dirty behind my back. Those that do. Please, won't you please means dear to me. You know that I love you true. You're holding no blade to stab me in the back, and I know that some do.
Listening to the Supertone Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that was John Martin, May You Never, from the fourth studio album Solid Air, released February 1973 on Island Records.
I feel very... it's just such a beautiful song.
It is. And the performance, produced by John Wood, this.
Mm.
Now, we know a bit about John Wood because the producer who's worked with on my second solo album, The Knife, is a guy called Andy Seward, who's a fantastic bass player, upright and normal, and a great producer, acoustic producer. And he's worked with John Wood an awful lot as his engineer. And John Wood designed the acoustic treatment in the Chairworks Studios, where we also recorded that, and we recorded Electrolyte and done quite a bit of recording at Chairworks, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So there we are. So we're going to get that little tenuous link there. But back to the performance.
I was going to say.
The acoustic guitar. The rhythm. He's hitting the body. He's so delicate. It is a magnificent, magnificent performance on acoustic guitar. And his vocals were great. And the first time, I'm sorry for going on here, but the first time I actually saw John Martin, he was on the Old Grey Whistle Test, and he had this Fender twin reverb, and Bob, Whispering Bob was there, you know, and he was sat right next to Whispering Bob, and he did, I think he did this song, actually, and he had an Echoplex, which is an old tape machine, like an old, which we've got one of those, I use it live all the time, and he was into effects, really, and he put his acoustic guitar to these effects, and it was fantastic. I thought, wow, it's an acoustic guitar with effects. It was amazing. Amazing.
Wow. Do you know what I love about John Martin, though? I remember when we were talking with Fiona, because Hamish Imlach, and we know Hamish's daughter Fiona,
yeah,
mentored John Martin.
That's
so
right,
he basically yeah. learned his guitar technique from Hamish Imlach, who's a Scottish legend. And also, Hamish is responsible for, well, basically, Billy Connolly actually borrowed his kind of storytelling. He learned a lot from Hamish, didn't he, Billy Connolly?
That's right. Yeah. And I've actually played Hamish's 12-string guild guitar, which is a magnificent thing. We've got one, but it's not as good as this one. It's a really old one. It's Hamish's original. And I was very honoured to play it because it's been played by John Martin and various other things.
Oh, it sounded delicious, didn't it? You could hear the ancestry in it. And then, obviously, when I got home and we found the cod liver oil and the orange juice,
yeah.
Which it's Hamish's. So if you haven't heard it, we've played it on the show before. We should put it on again, actually, because it's such a gorgeous song, and I love Hamish. I guess I love the fact that I love Fiona. I think she's one of the most beautiful people I've ever met.
Mm.
And to think that she, you know, and she is, I'm not just saying that, she really is. And it's just lovely to sort of be connected in with the heartbeat of musicians and their families, you know.
Yeah. When we stay there, we always end up singing and stuff. But, I mean, this whole album, Solid Air by John Martin, going back to John Martin, is that,
yeah.
I mean, it's got the rock and roll, the folk royalty on it. Richard Thompson's on it. Tristan Fry, who ended up being the percussionist with Sky. Remember John Williams' Sky?
Yeah.
Danny Thompson, Dave Pegg.
Oh, Peggy from Cropperty, isn't he, well, and Fairport Convention.
Yeah, who's actually played your filed acoustic bass. So we've got lots of connection with John Martin in a funny sort of way. Sadly, I never saw him live, but, you know, it's a marvellous song, beautifully performed, covered by Eric Clapton as well, didn't
he? That's right, he did that with the slow hand.
Yeah. Anyway, fantastic.
Well, they could have been called Muddy Rabbit, but they didn't go for that name. It's Creedence Clearwater Revival, and Have You Ever Seen the Rain? It's from their sixth studio album, Pendulum, which was released in December 1970 on Fantasy Records.
Muddy Rabbit?
Or Gossamer Wump.
What?
Yep, they had a few. Yeah, they changed their name because they had a couple of bands when they first got together. Because they were childhood friends, and they had they were, what were they called now? There was one band, they were called the Blue Velvets. That's right. I know when they first started playing off, so, when they were at school, because there was John Fogerty, his older brother Tom, and Stu Cook and Doug Clifford all gone to high school together. So they're called the Blue Velvets, and then they were called the Gollywogs.
No.
Yeah.
Blimey.
It's really weird, you know. And I looked at that when I read that, and there was a children's book character by Florence Kate Upton at the time. And it was about, it was the two Dutch dolls in the Gollywog. And then their manager, because it was an acceptable name, and obviously you've had all the branding and loads for years and years and years. Obviously, people were starting to wake up to the fact, actually, it's not a good thing. So the manager then said, look, I need you to change your name. And kept pressurising them. So that's what they had. They had Muddy Rabbit on the table. That's what I was talking about.
Muddy Rabbit on the table.
No. Oh, you know what I mean. Oi. So anyway, they changed their name in 1968. And it's not... There are three reasons why. Because they had a friend called Creedence Newball. So they changed Creedence as in Creed. You know, as in a Creed of the double E. And there was a television commercial for an Olympia brewing company, Clearwater. And the revival apparently was about, this is a bit trite actually, the four members' renewed commitment to their band. But anyway,
well,
Creedence Clearwater Revival,
was
there
all
you go.
About John Fogerty.
Yeah.
What true. An amazing voice. He produced this. A great songwriter. And I think this is what we're talking about in this particular show. I think we've had some marvellous songs on this show so far. I mean, absolutely fantastic. And this is such a classic. And the production, right at the beginning, it opens up, it builds throughout it, but it is timeless. It's absolutely timeless. It's, you know, acoustic, guitar, bass and drums right at the beginning, then a piano comes in, and then the Hammond organ, and that's it. It's an acoustic piano, but it's, and that's it. It's just a beautifully simple delivered song, an ultimate pop song. It's only 2 minutes, 50 odd seconds or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, just great. And the lyrics, apparently, were something to do with Vietnam. I mean, and their...
So they say.
So they say.
It's another case of, you know what? You can think all you like, unless you hear it from the horse's mouth.
Yeah.
Had nothing to do with that.
Lou Reed.
Exactly.
And that documentary that we saw, where it was cutting from the editor of Rolling Stone magazine to Lou Reed himself. And the editor from Rolling Stone magazine was sort of saying, oh, yeah, it's about this. And Lou Reed sort of said, well, you know, I don't even know what I was writing about. I just wrote some lyrics down and that's it. It doesn't mean anything at all. And it just shows this sort of, you know, complete, what's the word? Contrast between what people read into songs and what the artist is talking about. Like Bowie, I mean, he used to use that technique where he'd just write phrases down and cut them up with, cut the paper up with scissors and then just rearrange the phrases, didn't he?
Yeah, I think that's, having realised that people do that, I've decided now that whatever I intend when I write lyrics with you, I don't expect other people to actually understand it the way I've written it, because I think it's a very subjective reception of people listening to a music.
Mm.
And it's not for me to kind of determine what the meaning is, because I think it's very much a personal relationship with, you create the music and you send it out there. And after that, that's nothing to do with you in that sense, unless people come and see you live. And then you've got people in the room and they're in your living room, whether there's thousands in there or a couple of hundred, you're sharing the same space together. And that's when the music connects in a different way, I think. But no, apparently, I'm going to tell you now, this is verbatim because Fogerty said this. The song was about the fact that they were on top of the charts at the time, because they were number one in Canada, number two in Norway, number three in the Netherlands, number eight in the US, right? So the top of the charts, and they'd surpassed all of their wildest expectations of fame and fortune. They're rich, famous, but somehow all of the band at the time were depressed and unhappy.
No.
Yeah. See? Isn't it funny, though, because there's the art of happiness. And what does Steve Leach say to us, our friend who we play drums with the Devil Note? He says, be careful what you wish for.
he tires easily. Johnny thinks the world would be right if he could buy the truth from him. Mary says he changes his mind more than a woman, but she made a bet. Even when the chance was slim,
Johnny and Mary from the sixth studio album Clues, released September 1980. A bit later than our normal stuff, this.
I know.
A bit more electronic, a lot more electronic.
Yeah, but I think it's nice just to change it up a bit, and this is a really cracking song.
Well, it is a cracking song, yeah. Again, brilliantly written. And recorded in the Bahamas, I think, this one, wasn't it? Compass Point?
Yeah, that's right. Is he that moved right? out there, didn't he? Yeah. He was living in the Bahamas. It's a well, hard life.
Yeah, well, yeah. And he moved away, apparently, because of the drugs and violence on the island, gun crime and stuff. And he moved to Switzerland after this, and then he got divorced. But, yeah, so that was an interesting bit of his life. But I know quite a bit about Robert Palmer because I've been reading the Phil Brown book, Are We Still Rolling? Great book. Highly recommended to buy if you're into... It's not just about the engineering and the actual recording process and everything. The rock and roll stories in this book are fantastic. And Robert Palmer was known for his love of Bolivian marching powder.
Nicely put.
Charlie, whatever you like to call it. But there's fantastic stories in that book about Robert Palmer. He did quite a lot of work with him. But he didn't work with him on this album, sadly. And there's a bit of a story behind it. But on this album is Gary Numan, isn't it? Because he actually performed on it as well. And it's a, you know.
Guess who as well? Someone else.
Go on.
I've got a secret note.
No, go on.
Did you know Andy Fraser played on the album as well?
No.
Not on this particular track, but my eyes lit up when I read that, because I didn't know that Andy Fraser had written Palmer's first breakthrough single, Every Kind of People.
Right, I kind of remember that. Andy Fraser from Free.
Yeah, yeah.
So he must have been worth a bit of cash, the lad, because he wrote a lot of the Free stuff as well, didn't he, Andy?
Yeah, what I like as well, I think he was he played percussion on a Talking Heads album, and there's one of the guys from Talking Heads that plays drums.
This, Chris France,
yes. So Chris
plays, who's married to Tina Weymouth.
Exactly. Yeah. Now he plays on a track as well. So, but do you know, I love that because it's like, oh, I'll come play on your track, and then you can guest back in with me. Yeah. And that's a community thing. I really, really, really like that. And obviously the musicians were good enough as well, which is really important.
But what has happened to the world, it does not seem to happen as much anymore. And no. I still think it's down to the recording process. All these books that I'm reading, everyone, there's Jeff Emmerich, there's Phil Brown, I'm reading Ken...
Scott.
Ken Scott, guys, I forgot his name. Yeah, Ken Scott at the moment. You know, and each one talks about the beauty of the recording process in the 60s and 70s and how easy it was, how free it was, how collaborative it was. You know, there was a lot of, you know, nonsense went on, but, you know, generally speaking, the process was fantastic. No A&R men involved, really. No managers involved. It was right down to the artist. They had proper budgets to do the work properly, you know, and that's what it's all about. And it's lost so much now. It's lost so much.
It has. And talk about losing so much. We've run out of time, darling.
No!
We say that every week, don't we? It's like, actually, you usually tell me that we've run out of time. So anyway, I hope you've enjoyed this week's show. And if you want to get in contact with us, you can find us on Instagram, Starlight Campbell, that's Star LITE, Twitter at Susie and Simon, and Facebook.
And the show's available on Mixcloud, Spotify, iTunes, and iHeartRadio. So please tell your friends and see you next week.